This is Bloomberg Law with June Grosso from Bloomberg Radio.
At oral arguments, Supreme Court justices on both sides of the ideological spectrum signaled they're inclined to let Kentucky's Republican Attorney General take over the defense of a law that would sharply restrict abortion after the 15th week of pregnancy. The case is the opening act in a Supreme Court term that could eviscerate the constitutional right to an abortion. Joining me is Bloomberg Supreme Court reporter Greg Storr. Greg, how many abortion clinics are there in Kentucky?
There are two. They're both in Louisville, and there's only one, the EMW clinic that's at the center of the Supreme Court case, where you can get an abortion after 14 weeks of pregnancy.
And you went down there. Tell us about what it's like outside and going into the clinic.
Well, they perform abortions 5 days a week, and every day, I was only there for one, but I'm told it's every day, there are protesters out there. There are people, usually a group of Catholics who are praying the rosary. There are people with signs. On the day I was there, there was a preacher who had a microphone who was using that to amplify his voice. And, you know, inevitably, when patients start to come at 8 o'clock, there will be a group of people that try to talk to them and try to persuade them not to go inside.
I can imagine it's very intimidating to go into the clinic. Does it stop people from trying to get abortions? Do you know?
Not based on what I saw. There, you know, when I talked to some of the anti-abortion protesters out there, they did say there were examples. There are people they can point to that chose not to have an abortion. And one woman even showed me a picture of a woman with her family and said that she had been talked out of having an abortion. It's not clear how much of that actually happens at the actual site there, but folks say it does happen at least some of the time.
Does the clinic do anything to protect the women who are arriving there?
Well, on the morning I was there, there were about a half a dozen escorts. And what they say they do is basically just try to create space. When a woman parks her car, they go up to her and say, would you like me to walk in with you? And they walk alongside her and just serve as a little buffer. There's no physical contact that I've seen between escorts and protesters, but you know they give her somebody to walk alongside into the building.
And Kentucky has passed how many laws in the last 4 years? How many anti-abortion laws?
There are about a dozen laws that Kentucky has passed. It's a state that has mostly been controlled by Republicans, although there is now a Democratic governor. This particular law was actually passed overwhelmingly by the Kentucky General Assembly.
So tell us about this law that's at the center of the Supreme Court case.
Yeah, what this law does is basically ban abortion after about 15 weeks of pregnancy. It targets the most common technique used at that stage called dilation and evacuation, or D&E. And that procedure involves pulling the fetus out in a way that sometimes causes the tissue to separate. And what this law says is you can't, in quote, dismember the fetus unless it is already dead. And abortion providers say there's really no safe and effective way of performing an abortion if you have to first make sure that the fetus is dead. So essentially, this law makes it all but impossible to have an abortion after 15 weeks.
So now, what is the issue at the Supreme Court?
So the issue is actually, it's really important, but it's a somewhat technical issue. It has to do with the effort by the Republican Attorney General Daniel Cameron to take over the litigation. What happened was because of the changeover in the 2019 election in Kentucky, it meant that the governor's office went from being Republican to Democrat, and the attorney general's office went the other way, went from being Democrat to Republican. And after a federal appeals court struck this law down as being unconstitutional, the Democratic administration of Governor Andy Beshear decided not to press any further appeals. And the new Republican Attorney General, Daniel Cameron, said, I'd like to intervene and take over the defense of the law. The federal appeals court, the Sixth Circuit, said, no, you can't do that at such a late stage in the litigation. Cameron went up to the Supreme Court. So the Supreme Court is considering whether Cameron can be allowed to intervene and press further appeals, possibly including a Supreme Court appeal.
Justices from both sides of the ideological spectrum seemed concerned about the same thing.
Seemed to be that nobody would be allowed to defend this law, that you have a state where you have some officials who want to be able to keep pressing appeals and the lower court didn't let them do that. So even among some of the Democratic-appointed justices, Stephen Breyer, Elena Kagan, there was concern that the lower court ruling would bar the state from further defending the law. That is, of course, even though Justices Breyer and Kagan almost certainly would say this law is unconstitutional based on Supreme Court precedent.
What reason did the appellate court give for saying that the attorney general couldn't step in?
It's somewhat technical, but essentially the Sixth Circuit said he did it too late. So the attorney general in the form of Andy Beshear, who is now the governor, at an early stage in the litigation had said, I'm not going to defend the law and I'll abide by any judgment. Then the case went forward without Beshear defending it. The state lost at the district court level. The health secretary, a Republican, appealed up to the Sixth Circuit. Still, the attorney general's office is not involved. And then after the Sixth Circuit ruled, that's when Daniel Cameron, after he had been elected, said, I want to intervene now and I want to seek review by a bigger panel of judges, so-called en banc review at the Sixth Circuit, and the Sixth Circuit said, no, it's too late for you to jump in and do that.
This is a procedural question. Why might this case be important in the battle over abortion rights?
Well, it's important because if Cameron loses in this case, this Kentucky law is void. It can't be defended anymore. So it matters just in terms of this particular law. You know, it's also, a bit of a prelude. This is going to be a huge Supreme Court term for abortion rights. In December, they're going to hear arguments on this Mississippi law. Mississippi is asking the Supreme Court to gut or even overturn the Roe v. Wade ruling. And then, of course, you've got the Texas law floating around out there, too, and the court might be asked to get back involved in that case. That involves a ban after 6 weeks of pregnancy. And so this case, could give us some signals as to what the court's going to do on those bigger questions. Certainly, it's starting to whet people's appetite for this big topic of abortion.
It seems a little bit convenient that you have that Mississippi case and then you have the Texas case and this case all sort of coming to a head at the same time. Is that just coincidence?
It's not. We have a much more conservative Supreme Court right now. There's a lot of reasons to think they will be more receptive to abortion restrictions than the court has been. And because of that, people who are opposed to abortion are passing more laws at the state level, filing more appeals, pushing the issue because they think they have a real chance to change the law, maybe even to go as far as overturning Roe v. Wade, but certainly giving states more ability to enact tough abortion restrictions.
From all indications, the justices are going to rule that the Kentucky Attorney General has to be allowed to defend the law.
Yeah, it sure seems like that's what's going to happen, that they will say that he can take over the defense, press further appeals. It seems like that is going to get at least 6 votes and maybe as many as 8.
And tell us, according to polls, most Americans still support a right to abortion. What do they feel about restrictions?
They do support the general right to an abortion, but they also support restrictions. Now, what exactly that means, is a bit in the details, and it might depend on how the question is asked. Even though in this abortion debate at the Supreme Court, sometimes it might seem like both sides are very absolutist. A lot of people in the American public are somewhere in the middle and do think that there should be some right to end a pregnancy, but not an absolute right.
And also in your story, you talk about how while in the U.S., states in recent years have been enacting more and more laws to try to restrict abortion rights or even ban them, while in other countries, Catholic countries, they've been going in the opposite direction.
Yeah, it's quite remarkable that this is happening. Sometimes you see the United States moving in tandem with other countries, but Mexico, Ireland both have started allowing or at least giving more freedom for women to end pregnancies. In the U.S., again, in large part, or certainly in part, because of the knowledge that you have a more conservative Supreme Court, the anti-abortion forces are certainly on the march.
So while I have you, last term when it was over the phone, the oral arguments, you had the Chief Justice going in order of seniority for the questioning. So it was very ordered, unlike the hot bench we might have seen in the past. What's it like this term when they're back in the courtroom?
It's a bit of a hybrid. It's not totally back to the free-for-all that we used to have, where you didn't know who was going to jump in when. Curiously, in, I believe, every argument so far, in every half of each argument, the first question has been asked by Justice Clarence Thomas. And, you know, he's a guy who went a decade without asking a question previously, didn't like participating in oral arguments. It seems as though the justices have all collectively agreed that they're going to let Justice Thomas ask the first question, and apparently that he's now comfortable doing that, it's changed the dynamic of the argument just because you get to hear a little bit of what he thinks during it.
And then at the end, the Chief Justice says, basically, anybody got any more questions?
Yeah, and he tries to do that in seniority order, which means that when he's on the bench, he's looking back and forth. First, Justice Thomas, do you have anything? Then Justice Breyer, do you have anything? It can be a little bit awkward, but in general, the arguments, what it's done is it has let all the justices, or it seems like it's let all the justices know that they will have a chance to ask their question. They may just have to be patient and wait till the end.
And how many people are in the courtroom itself?
It has been something south of maybe 80 or so. Depends on the case a little bit. It's basically just the lawyers who are arguing, the lawyer who's arguing and one other lawyer on each side, a few members of the press, the justices' law clerks, and a few other court officials and special guests. General public is excluded. You know, at most, maybe the courtroom is a quarter filled, a lot less than in a normal argument.
Thanks so much for being on the show, Greg. That's Bloomberg News Supreme Court reporter Greg Storr. It's a closely watched case with implications for how states manage natural resources nationwide. Mississippi claims that Tennessee's pumping of an interstate aquifer is vacuuming slow-moving underground water into the Memphis area that could not occur naturally, increasing costs of Mississippi's water pumping. At the oral arguments, the justices cast doubt on Mississippi's claim for damages. Joining me is Robin Craig, a professor at USC Gould School of Law. Robin, tell us about the issue here.
So in Mississippi versus Tennessee, we have an interstate dispute over a shared water resource. That's not new. What's new is two things. First of all, this is the first case to reach the Supreme Court arguing about groundwater in an aquifer. And second, what's interesting about this case is that Mississippi is not arguing the traditional argument that states make in this situation, which is for equitable apportionment of the aquifer among the states that share it, but rather it's arguing a territorial claim, basically asserting that because Memphis is pumping so much water and creating a cone of depression in the aquifer that crosses into Mississippi's territory, that Mississippi should be entitled to some fairly large damages. So basically, Mississippi is arguing that Tennessee is stealing its groundwater.
Was there one issue that dominated the oral arguments?
Probably what the correct cause of action should be. There were really two issues that came up in oral argument. One was what the justices should do with the case if they dismissed it. But the main one was, does Mississippi really have a territorial sovereignty claim to the groundwater, or should this really be an equitable apportionment case? And, it was interesting because the justices were interested both in how to distinguish Mississippi's potential claim factually from things that go on with surface water. But they were also interested in the limits of their equitable apportionment jurisdiction. So they didn't seem to want to go with Mississippi, but they were also a little bit concerned about how many of these groundwater cases they might get in the future.
Explain equitable apportionment.
Okay, equitable apportionment is the doctrine that the Supreme Court made up to accommodate cases where states share natural resources. It's usually water, an interstate river, for example. And the one state, it's almost always the downstream state, is complaining that the upstream state is taking too much of the resource. And so equitable apportionment, states come to the Supreme Court through original jurisdiction, so they don't have to go through the trial court, and then ask the court to basically divide the resource among the states that share it. With water in particular, the Supreme Court recognized early on that having access to water, having a water supply, is an important aspect of state sovereignty. So equitable apportionment at its core is a way to accommodate conflicting claims of sovereignty over resources without having the states go to war with each other.
At one point, did the justices question whether this was actually water or not, this groundwater?
Yes. Chief Justice Roberts actually got into an interesting little conversation about the science of groundwater and his understanding that when water is sitting in an aquifer, at least some kinds of aquifers, it's not really just a pool of water sitting on bedrock. It's mud or silt or, in this case, water mixed with sand. And so he asked, is that really water? Or is it mud or silt until you pull it up to the surface? Counsel for Tennessee, I think, quite properly answered, you can withdraw it as relatively pure water. And in fact, groundwater is some of the purest water you can withdraw, which is why cities like to use it for drinking water. So, but yes, it was an interesting question. Didn't seem to concern most of the rest of the court, but that was an interesting bit of questioning there.
And Justice Sonia Sotomayor seemed sort of exasperated with Mississippi for bringing these damages. She said, both courts told you you've got to seek equitable apportionment. Now, this is the third time you've done this. When is enough enough?
Exactly. And that goes to that second issue of what if the court is not going to allow Mississippi to have its territorial claim, what should it do with the case? This case has been going on for a while, 16 years. Mississippi has made a couple of attempts to make this argument. And so Justice Sotomayor was getting at an issue that a lot of the justices asked about in one form or another, of if the court says Mississippi can't bring this claim, does it dismiss the case with prejudice? Does it say, well, you never raised equitable apportionment, so if you want to raise that, file a new case? Or does it let Mississippi go back and just amend its complaint and add an equitable apportionment claim? Like I said, there was a fair amount of questioning on that to various degrees. There were a couple of justices who seemed a little more sympathetic to Mississippi, saying, hey, you want to preserve that claim, don't you, if we decide against you on the law? There were a couple of justices who seemed willing to grab the procedural out and maybe just be able to dismiss this case on the grounds that Mississippi had not asked to amend its complaint, and Mississippi has steadfastly refused to allege an equitable apportionment claim. And it's like, okay, if you decide you want to bring that claim, fine, but you're going to have to file a whole new lawsuit to do it. So that's one of the things that will be interesting to see, is what they actually decide to do with the disposition of the case if they rule against Mississippi.
A court-appointed special master earlier ruled that Mississippi should have pursued a claim for equitable apportionment. Why doesn't Mississippi want to pursue that equitable apportionment? What would it get from equitable apportionment?
Well, Mississippi's view of equitable apportionment is it's mainly a prospective remedy. It tells the states how to behave in the future, who's entitled to how much water or how much pumping from an aquifer. And what it really wants is damages. It thinks its sovereignty has been intruded upon. It's sort of the state-level equivalent of a trespass, and it wants those damages. And under equitable apportionment claims, there are ways to get damages, but not until the offending state has clearly taken more than its fair share, which usually requires that you've divided up the resource in the first place. So that's the difference from Mississippi's perspective.
Has Mississippi suffered any damages here?
Not according to Tennessee. aside from that injury or perceived injury to its sovereignty, there seems to be plenty of water in the aquifer. Mississippi also has pumps along the border. Everybody seems to be getting all the water they need. So not in the typical sense of an injury in these cases. Another reason why Mississippi doesn't want to go the equitable apportionment route, because before a state can actually get the court to equitably apportion a water body, it has to show pretty substantial injury from what the other states are doing. And I have seen no facts that would indicate that Mississippi could make that showing.
The Biden administration and a bipartisan group of states sided with Tennessee. Why did they side with Tennessee?
Pretty much everyone is siding with Tennessee. I think the states are mostly Western states who have been involved in either equitably apportioning rivers or interstate compacts to govern rivers. And even those interstate compacts, however, tend to be based on the background principles of equitable apportionment, that all states are co-equal sovereigns and they should be able to share in the resource. Coming up with a completely new rule for groundwater has the potential to upend how states think about sharing these resources in general. The other complication that could come up and is increasingly coming up is in these agreements about surface water, it is becoming increasingly clear for a lot of them that groundwater pumping can affect the surface water as well. And so there's been a few interstate compact cases before the court in the last few years where nothing was going wrong with the surface water per se, except that groundwater pumping in one state or the other was affecting the surface water. There was so much groundwater pumping going on that it was actually drawing down the surface water. And so these cases have been coming up of whether that hydrologically connected groundwater is part of the original compact. Now, to some extent, that depends on what the compact originally said. But if the Supreme Court suddenly announces a completely different rule for shared groundwater, then eventually we're going to run into the problem not only of how to apply that rule as a practical matter, which is part of what the justices were getting at in this case, but also what to do in these other cases when it turns out that the groundwater and the surface water are so intimately connected that we really need to do to wrap in the groundwater to effectuate the surface water agreement. So there are a lot of complications that could come up with that, from that. But I think a large part of it is also, equitable apportionment isn't easy, but we understand it. We know how it works. We can deal with it. Don't throw us a whole new set of rules in these cases or these situations that are already fairly complicated to negotiate.
So it seems pretty clear from the oral arguments that Mississippi is going to lose. But is the question what the justices decide to do with the case?
I think so, yes. I agree with you. I think it's pretty clear that Mississippi is going to lose. The interesting question for me is how much more the court decides it wants to say. This actually could be one of the shortest Supreme Court opinions in an interstate water case ever written. If the court basically just wants to say Mississippi has alleged this territorial claim to groundwater, there is no legal basis for that claim. It has failed to state a cause of action. Case dismissed. The opinion really could be that short. if the justices decide instead that they want to get into some of the other issues that were raised, start to talk about the role of state sovereignty. There was an interesting debate that came up at the end of the case, where the United States had one view of state sovereignty and the role of equitable apportionment, and Mississippi had a very different view. You know, if they want to get into that, if they want to get into the limits of equitable apportionment itself, trying to put some bumpers on that doctrine to stem what some of the justices were clearly fearing would be a flood of these groundwater cases, then it could get to be a very interesting opinion and could really influence interstate water law for probably the rest of the century. If I had to put money on it, I think they're going to go with the shorter opinion and save the complicated questions for when they actually get a complaint asking for equitable apportionment of an aquifer. But you never know. They might decide that they want to say something about those other issues in the process.
It seems like there have been a few of these water rights cases between states. Is there a reason why they're popping up now?
I think so, yes. The cases that are coming up now are eastern cases. So the big one last term was Florida versus Georgia, which has been going on forever. That's a debate. The Western, there actually was a very early interstate equitable apportionment case between New York and New Jersey. But aside from that, most of the big cases have involved Western states, Western rivers, dry country, very easy to overuse those rivers, overappropriate them, take too much water out. But the eastern states, I think, are starting to run into some of the same issues that their water supplies aren't as secure as they used to be. There are big cities that need more water than local supplies actually allow for. And we're also getting some situations in the western states where the agreements that were hashed out in some cases a century ago are now being tested by new climatological conditions. They didn't put in provisions to deal with a warming climate or, bigger flood disasters or whatnot. And so I think for both reasons, the agreements we thought were settled decades ago are suddenly becoming more problematic again. And we have a whole new set of states that are running into interstate water issues in ways that they traditionally haven't. And so I think we're going to keep seeing, a few of these cases sprinkled in before the Supreme Court. Most terms going forward.
Thanks for being on the Bloomberg Law Show, Robin. That's Professor Robin Craig of USC Gould School of Law. And that's it for this edition of the Bloomberg Law Show. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.